history of immigrant detention in the United States. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Well, Thursday at this time means it's time for the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson. And today I'm going to have a couple of responses to Tuesday's election. And the second one will be quite... very interesting. George Galloway, kind of a loud rant. But first off, we're going to start with Professor John Mearsheimer on the Judging Freedom website with Judge Napolitano. And this was posted yesterday.
Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Napolitano here for Judging Freedom. Today is Wednesday, November 6, 2024. Professor John Mearsheimer joins us now. Professor Mearsheimer, welcome here. I want to spend a fair amount of time with you on the developments in Israel. I want to ask you a few questions about Ukraine, but before I get to either of them, of course, I cannot avoid mentioning the election outcome. 2 days ago, now President-elect Trump named two people that would be his candidates to become Secretary of Defense. They are former CIA Director and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. And I scratched my head. I thought, do the neocons run the foreign policy establishment no matter who the president is? What do you think?
Well, I mean, Trump promised that this time was going to be different than 2017, 2021, his first term. And when he says that people like Mike Pompeo and Tom Cotton are going to be in key decision-making positions, one can only wonder, what is he talking about? They are pure establishment, and they're both basically neoconservatives. They're as hawkish as they come, and they will work mightily to undermine Trump's radical agenda that he set out. So I wouldn't bet a lot of money in the final analysis that Trump will end up changing American foreign policy in any meaningful way, certainly if he's going to appoint people like this.
Doesn't he have $100 million debt to Mrs. Sheldon Adelson? And you know what she wants.
Well, there's no question on Israel, and I think even on China, that Trump was not going to be much different than Biden. And in fact, Biden was not much different than Trump on both China and the Middle East. The key issue where Trump says he's going to matter is the Ukraine-Russia issue. He wants to improve relations with Putin and the Russians more generally, and he's been bragging that he could put an end to the Ukraine war. I've long believed that no matter who he puts in power, whether it's a restrainer or somebody like Mike Pompeo, it's not going to make much difference on Ukraine. In large part because I think the Ukraine issue is going to be settled on the ground, on the battlefield. And I don't think that Trump could reach any form of meaningful agreement with Russia that would end the war independent of what's happening on the battleground. The fact is that the Russians, and this is especially true of Putin, don't trust the West at all anymore, and they don't trust Donald Trump any more than they trust Kamala Harris. And they're going to drive a remarkably hard bargain, the Russians are. And it's going to be, in my opinion, almost impossible for Trump or any other person to agree to Russian terms.
Colonel Douglas McGregor agrees with you 100% on all this. He has referred to Ukraine as a collapse in slow motion, although the motion is not so slow anymore. How rapidly is the Russian military moving west, and how devastating has that move been to the Ukraine military?
Well, there's no question, as Doug McGregor has said on numerous occasions, that the Russian steamroller is moving steadily westward, inflicting significant casualties on the Ukrainians, and it's clear that the Russians are going to win. I think it's a very interesting question to ask, what are the consequences of yesterday's election on what's going to happen on the battlefield? If you think about it, the Ukrainians are in really deep trouble, and they're barely hanging on.
And they're in deep trouble because they listened to the Americans and the British in 2022.
There's no question about that. And they listened to the British and the Americans in 2023 when they launched the famous counteroffensive on June 4th. This is June 4th, 2023, which proved to be a colossal failure.
Just like their incursion into Kursk has proven to be a colossal failure.
Yeah, assuming that the Americans and the British did encourage them to go into Kursk. I don't know that that's a fact. I wouldn't be surprised, given that it was a foolish decision, and the Americans and the British are specialized in bad advice. So it's likely, or it's at least plausible that that's the case. But the point I was making to you is, if you're the Ukrainian military, you're barely hanging on, it looks like you're going to lose the war, independent of who gets elected on November 5th. And then you see that Donald Trump is elected. Donald Trump, who's basically threatened to cut off all aid to Ukraine, which means it's all over for Ukraine. Are these people going to continue to fight on the way they have been fighting since when the war broke out in February 2022?
Just as meaningful a question I would submit is, are Joe Biden and Tony Blinken going to continue to pour money down a rat hole, knowing what will happen on January 20th?
Well, they'll continue to pour money down a rat hole because they'll want to do everything they can to make sure that Ukraine holds on until they lose office, so that when Ukraine finally collapses, it does so on Trump's watch, and they can blame Trump and say only if Kamala Harris had been elected, we wouldn't have had this terrible outcome.
This would be tit for tat, because Trump negotiated the departure of American troops from Afghanistan, but it didn't happen until Biden's watch. It was perceived as a colossal disaster, and they blamed Biden.
That's exactly what happened.
Well, but back to Ukraine. What do you think the European elites, you know these people, are now thinking? What are they going to do? Are they going to ramp up their aid to Ukraine, or are they going to accept the inevitable, which I would submit, and you probably agree, without the United States, Ukraine doesn't have a leg to stand on, no pun intended.
I would make one minor correction. With the United States, Ukraine doesn't have a
right. I mean, nicely put. But what are they thinking in Rome and in Berlin and London and Paris now about Ukraine?
I would make two points. Number one, just like the Americans, they've run out of patience, they've run out of weapons, and they've run out of money, and they're not interested in throwing any more assistance in Ukraine, or any meaningful assistance in Ukraine's direction. They've basically given up. The interesting point to me is that they really don't believe that if Russia wins in Ukraine, it's a great threat to Eastern Europe, much less them in Western Europe. You know, there's all this talk that if Putin wins in Ukraine, he's going to end up conquering all of Ukraine. Then he's going to march eastward and act much like the Soviet Union did during the Cold War. If the Europeans really believed that, they would be building up their defenses to protect themselves. But if you look at how much money they're spending, and if you look at the state of the militaries across Europe, and this is especially includes the British and German militaries, these are militaries that are in pathetic shape and in no position to contest the Russians. But they're not trying to rectify the situation, and they're not trying to rectify the situation because they know deep down Russia is not a meaningful threat. That means that their interest, their commitment to making sure that Ukraine stops Russia is just not that great. So the Russians are going to end up winning an ugly victory here.
So how much longer can Ukraine possibly last? Ritter says they're losing 12,000. They have 12,000 casualties a day between killed in action and severely injured in action. I mean, do the math. I don't know how many more bodies they have.
Well, it's not simply a question of bodies. It's also a question of willpower. And the argument I was making about Trump's election is that I think that will have a significant negative effect on Ukrainian willpower. And I think willpower does matter here. But if you marry your comments about the number of casualties with my comments about willpower, it's hard to imagine the Ukrainian military lasting more than a few more months. You would think that at some point in the not too distant future, they're just going to have to quit because they don't have the manpower or the will to continue fighting.
How colossal a disaster has the American and British experiment in Ukraine been in the past 2 years? I mean, there's no good whatsoever that has come from it.
Absolutely. But it goes back to the April 2008 decision.
Right.
Ukraine into NATO. That was a colossal mistake. It's just hard to believe what a catastrophic decision that was. Because you want to understand that not only has Ukraine been wrecked in the process, not only have hundreds of thousands of people died, and Ukraine has been turned into a dysfunctional rump state. But once we get a frozen conflict, relations in Europe between Russia on one side and Ukraine and the West on the other side are going to be poisoned for as far as the eye can see. The German economy has been hurt. This is going to do significant damage to NATO. The potential for this frozen conflict to turn into a hot conflict is going to be very great because there are all sorts of flashpoints in Eastern Europe, like the Arctic, the Baltic, Kaliningrad, Belarus, Moldova, and the Black Sea, where you could have a future conflict cause this frozen conflict to turn into a hot conflict. So this was just a disastrous decision. It's hard to believe that we made it.
Let's transfer over to Israel, Professor Mearsheimer. In the past week, the Israeli press has revealed that top secret Israeli documents were leaked. One of the three people arrested was the principal spokesman for Prime Minister Netanyahu. The documents, if true, reveal that Netanyahu was the one preventing ceasefire negotiations from proceeding to an amicable resolution so as to bring home the hostages. Netanyahu, in turn, fired his defense minister, Yoav Gallant. Gallant says he was fired because he insisted that the ultra-Orthodox and Orthodox, consistent with a 6-1 ruling of the Supreme Court of Israel, be subject to the draft, and that there be some serious effort made at a ceasefire to get the hostages home, and that there be an investigation as to exactly what happened on October 7th, and when he made those demands public and privately to Prime Minister Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu fired him. Has Netanyahu again shot himself in the foot, or has he avoided another self-inflicted wound?
Well, he has a truly impressive ability to shoot himself in the foot, but he also has a truly impressive ability to survive. So he's done a remarkably large number of foolish things before October 7th. Remember, he supported Hamas before October 7th, and he's done a remarkably large number of foolish things since October 7th. But he has survived, and his political position today looks like it's firmly intact. But let me just say a few words about his relationship with Gallant. I think there are three issues, two of which you identified, but there's a third one that's also very important. As you pointed out, there's a big dispute between the two of them on the ultra-Orthodox and bringing the ultra-Orthodox into the military, making them serve. And Gallant, of course, wants to do that. And Netanyahu, for political reasons, doesn't. And that's a huge bone of contention. The second bone of contention has to do with getting the hostages back, as you pointed out. But related to that, and very importantly, a big issue between the two of them for a long time now is that Gallant has wanted Netanyahu to give his plan for what Gaza would look like once the shooting stopped. Gallant believed that somebody has to administer Gaza, and that somebody has to be on the Palestinian side. And Gallant wanted to know what the plan was. But again, because Netanyahu is interested in ethnically cleansing Gaza and wants nobody left when he's done, he doesn't come up with a plan. He refuses to come up with a plan. And of course, if you refuse to come up with a plan, you're not going to get the hostages back. But Gallant kept pestering him for the plan. And finally, that, combined with the other two factors, caused Netanyahu to fire him.
I wonder if he fired him to get this issue of the documents off the front page. I mean, Haaretz, which you and I read, has referred to it, as all these things are today, mimicking Watergate as BBgate. Here's former Defense Minister Gallant yesterday summarizing what he says are the reasons that he was dismissed. Cut number six.
This dismissal comes as a result of a dispute on three issues. The first, my firm stance that everyone who is eligible to be drafted to the military must be drafted to the military. They must serve in the IDF and protect the state of Israel. Second topic, our moral obligation to return our sons and daughters, the hostages. The third topic, the need to implement learning from the mistakes of the war. I support a deep investigation into looking into who is responsible, and I call for a national commission of inquiry.
I suggest to you that it's the third of those three that Netanyahu most fears.
Probably. Gallant should fear it, too. It's quite remarkable that he's calling for that investigation, because you want to remember he was the Minister of Defense on October 7th, and he bears significant responsibility for what happened. Of course, Netanyahu is the Prime Minister, and he bears ultimately responsibility. The buck stops at his desk. But both of them would be treated harshly, I'm sure, by any kind of independent investigation of the events of that day.
Is the IDF still intent on so degrading Gaza that no human being can live there?
That's certainly the case in northern Israel. I think they're basically trying to ethnically cleanse northern Gaza by murdering huge numbers of Palestinians and making life unlivable for people who remain there, and hoping that they can drive people into the southern half of Gaza. Whether they succeed is another matter. But what's happening there is catastrophic.
So Netanyahu says he had three or four goals, to defeat Hamas, to secure the safe return of the hostages, to facilitate the safe return of the settlers into northern Israel. Can any argument whatsoever be made that he has succeeded in any of those three goals?
No, but you're leaving out what I think is his most important goal. And his most important goal is to cleanse Gaza. He wants to empty Gaza of Palestinians. This was the point I made before about why he and Gallant have been fighting. Gallant wants a peace plan for administering Gaza once the shooting stops. And Netanyahu refuses to give him that peace plan, in large part because Netanyahu is committed to driving the Palestinians out.
This is genocide per se. If he were tried for genocide, all they'd have to do is put up tapes of what he'd said as part of the prosecution's case.
It is genocide. There's just no question about that. What's happened here is that they started out after October 7th with a bombing campaign that they thought would quickly result in driving the Palestinians out of Gaza and eventually out of the West Bank as well. But it failed. The Palestinians did not leave. And in effect, what's happened is that the massacres, the early massacres, have morphed into a genocidal campaign. And that's what you see happening now. And just to remind viewers, it's important to remember that the United States, and here we're talking about the Biden administration, is complicit in that genocide.
Whatever you do.
How successful, if at all, was the Israeli offensive against Iran, the last one, which is now about 10 days ago? The Wall Street Journal claims that it's seriously, the Israelis seriously crippled Iran's defenses and sent a message to the world that the Israelis can hit any target in Tehran at will. Is there any evidence for such a claim?
No, I think that the Israeli offensive ran into significant problems. It's very hard to get details that you can rely on regarding what exactly happened with the Israeli offensive. But it's clear that it didn't go as planned, and that they did limited damage. There's no question they did some damage, but they did limited damage inside of Iran. Moreover, they did not go after the nuclear targets. They did not go after the energy or oil targets. They did not pursue a decapitation strategy. They just didn't do a lot of damage. But I want to make another point. Even if they did a lot of damage, even if they tore apart the air defenses and Iran was vulnerable to an Israeli attack, a future Israeli attack, the fact is that Iran can still retaliate against Israel because Israel doesn't have the capability to prevent Iran from hitting a wide assortment of targets inside of Israel. This is a situation where both sides, take away the air defenses on both sides have the capability to retaliate against each other. Israel does not have escalation dominance. So it doesn't make a lot of sense for Israel to play tit for tat with Iran, because as they go up the escalation ladder, or Israel doesn't dominate Iran. And in fact, Israel absorbs significant punishment. So Israel is in deep trouble vis-a-vis Iran, whether or not they take out the air defenses or not. And as best we can tell, they did not do a satisfactory job of taking out the air defenses. And by the way, this is why they want to drag us, the United States, into their fight against Iran, because they understand full well they don't have escalation dominance. They understand they're having problems tearing apart Iranian air defenses, and they understand full well that they can't take out the Iranian nuclear capabilities without us. So they're trying to drag us in. But thankfully, they've been unsuccessful at that attempt.
I want you to listen to what retired four-star General Jack Keane told one of my former colleagues and still a friend at Fox News 2 days ago. Cut number three.
Military effects of that strike is beyond what's being reported, because they have literally taken down most of the Russian air defense system, the so-called S-300 missile defense systems that the Russians gave them years ago. And that's what's really protecting their nuclear enterprise, their oil and gas industry, and other key strategic assets, like the missile production factories that the Israelis did destroy at multiple sites. Those were ballistic missile factories, by the way. So yes, this air defense system destruction is really powerful, because Iran is sitting there essentially naked.
Is there any evidence to support that? Iran is sitting there essentially naked?
No, I would argue that his comments failed the common sense test. I think if the Israelis had been as successful as he describes, we'd be hearing about it. The Israelis would be putting their successes up in bright lights and telling everybody how formidable the Israeli Air Force is, and they would be advertising the fact that Iran is naked. But you don't see them doing that, and you don't see them doing that because they actually ran into a significant amount of trouble. But I want to reemphasize the point I made earlier, that even if it was true, Iran still maintains the capability to retaliate against Israel and do devastating damage.
Professor Mearsheimer, if Israel cannot penetrate Iran's defenses, can the United States?
Oh, I think we could, yeah. I think we have significant capabilities. This isn't to say that we wouldn't get our hair messed in the process. We surely would. But the United States has the capability to tear apart Iranian's defenses and to hit all sorts of targets. And there is some real chance that we could take out their nuclear capabilities. They would, of course, rebuild them, and they would end up with nuclear weapons. So it would be foolish to try to do that. But I think in terms of our ability, with our air power and our missile power, we could definitely tear apart their air defenses at some cost again, and then go after a wide-ranging target set in Iran. But I want to make it very clear, it is not in our interest to do this. And this is why we have gone to great lengths to avoid a war with Iran, because we understand that even if we have this capability, if you play it out and you think about where it all leads, it doesn't have a happy ending.
Can you enlighten us all on the BBGate document leak and the arrest of his chief spokesperson, who sought bail and bail was denied by the court? I mean, can you imagine if that were here? That would be like Admiral Kirby. I'm not casting aspersions at all, but with a person in that position being arrested for leaking classified documents to embarrass the president, would be that equivalent if it happened here?
Well, I think what's going on here is that these documents that were leaked were designed to give the impression that it was Hamas, not Netanyahu, who was delaying the negotiations over a ceasefire and the release of the hostages. These documents, which in good part were false documents, were designed to give the impression that Hamas was responsible for the delay in the negotiations, not Netanyahu. And it was also designed to make it look like that Hamas was interested in taking the hostages and moving them to Egypt, and Sinwar himself was looking to escape from Gaza with the hostages. You know, the idea that Sinwar is really kind of a coward and they're trying to get the hostages out, and Israel's going to therefore have to try to prevent this. None of this, of course, was true.
So adding to your argument about the fact that these documents were fake is the identity of the lawyer who showed up at the bail hearing for this now former spokesperson for Benjamin Netanyahu. The same lawyer defending Benjamin Netanyahu in his criminal cases. So if Admiral Kirby is going to be arrested for releasing secret documents, he's not going to get Joe Biden's lawyer.
But I just want to say that, as you well know, and we've talked about on the show, and your other guests talk about on the show all the time, leaders leak all the time.
Yes.
It's not the leaking of documents that really is the issue here. It's the fact that these were mainly false documents.
And that Netanyahu obviously knew about it and sought to benefit from it.
Of course. I'd truly be shocked if he didn't know what was going on here. He does this stuff all the time. And by the way, he's very effective at it. That's why he has been able to shoot himself in the foot on so many occasions and nevertheless escape almost unscathed.
The first phone call that Donald Trump took from a foreign leader was from Benjamin Netanyahu. Do you think he is sleeping well tonight that Trump was elected, believing that he can take on Iran and the 7th Fleet and 101st Airborne, or whatever they call themselves today, will be there beside his IDF?
I don't think that Netanyahu in the end cares that much whether it's Trump or Biden. I think that he fully understands that Israel basically owns the United States, regardless of who's president. I mean, Trump might be a bit more sympathetic, but who knows? And Netanyahu probably understands that Trump is something of a loose cannon. And, you know, Biden, you couldn't be more pro-Israel than Joe Biden. I mean, it'd be hard to imagine that Trump is going to be more pro-Israel. He might be slightly less pro-Israel. But in the final analysis, it doesn't matter, because if Netanyahu has any trouble with an American president, he just calls up the lobby goes to work, and the American president falls in line. I mean, you know as well as I do, this is how U.S.-Israeli relations work. They're in the driver's seat, not us.
All he has to do after January 20th is call Miriam Adelson in Las Vegas, Nevada, and his wishes will be taken care of.
Well, I mean, I don't know whether he has to call her. I mean,
well, she is the biggest donor.
He's the biggest donor, but there are all sorts of other individuals and groups that he can call. There are just many ways that he can get to Trump. But he's not going to have any problems with Trump, and he had no problems with Biden. He's pretty much gotten everything he wanted.
Professor Mearsheimer, always a pleasure. We missed you last week. Your audiences were blessed to be able to hear you, even though knowing you, you stirred the pot and caused some of them to have sleepless nights. Am I right?
I hope I did.
Thank you, my dear professor.
So that was Professor John Mearsheimer, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. He's been there a long time. And that was on Judge Napolitano's Judging Freedom website. And that was posted yesterday. I want to tell you about... it's going to be a community teach-in a week from tonight on No Weapons, No War. Learn and share knowledge about weapons manufacturers operating in Minnesota. Their deep reach into the metro area, the history of resistance against them, and what we can do now. It's going to be at the New City Center, used to be Walker Church, at 31st and 16th Avenue South. It'll be upstairs in the second floor. And it's put on by WAM, Women Against Military Madness, a week tonight, from tonight. And that'll be at 6:30 p.m. Well, this is the Northern Sun radio show with your host, Don Olson, here on KFAI 90.3 FM. Now I'm going to be playing something I taped, George Galloway, his election special. He's a lefty, left-winger from who is in London, and he has a program he calls MOAT, M-O-A-T, the mother of all talk shows. And he's going to be talking in a loud manner as to why he, what he thought about the election. So bear with this. And this was just last night.
Boys and girls, they, them of the Liberal Democratic Party are now weeping, weeping copiously. The meltdown.
Yes, that's
right. Commentators and journalists on both sides of the Atlantic makes one glad still to be alive to see it. Some of us are not happy that Donald Trump is the President of the United States. But we are ecstatic that Kamala Harris is not. Who would have thought that enabling mass murder and genocide and laughing about it on the way out of your convention? Who would have thought that disinterring Dick Cheney, that most people thought was dead, the murderer and torturer of Iraq, parading around his progeny as the future heads of the FBI and the CIA. I'm not making any of this up. Who would have thought that that would not have worked? A human Molotov cocktail called Donald Trump has, as predicted exclusively by me on the mother of all talk shows, won by a landslide. The popular vote by millions. The Electoral College decisively, the House of Representatives and the Senate. A complete red wave has swept away the Democratic Party. And if you think I'm laughing inside, you're absolutely right. It is the mother of all talk shows. Don't miss it.
Curious about our curriculum.
It is an extraordinary thing to be proved right so comprehensively. The Molotov cocktail that is Donald Trump has exploded with full force in the ranks of the soy progressives, the liberals everywhere. The preferential pronouns brigade have been butchered at the butcher's block of the electorate in the United States of America. And the meltdown is spectacular. Der Spiegel, yes, Der Spiegel of Germany has anointed Ursula von der Leyen as the leader of the free world, or what's left of it, as they say. This is Trump derangement syndrome on a monumental scale. It's not that Donald Trump's policies are alien to them, certainly not Der Spiegel, if you know anything about their history. It is his vulgarity. It is his roughness. It is his brutishness that is the bone that sticks in their throat. They want blood. They want war. They want the working class to be driven into the ground. They want the rich and already comfortable to be richer and more comfortable still. All the things that the Republican Party traditionally stands for. But they want it described with a certain finesse, and nowadays they want it to be painted in rainbow colors. I saw a black woman from the Democratic Party strategy group in the middle of the night on Al Jazeera saying, I need you to hear me. We consider Donald Trump to be racist, sexist, misogynist, and homophobic. This from a factotum of an administration which has murdered hundreds of thousands of women and children over the last 12 months in Gaza. They were only Arabs. How's that for racism? They were only Arab women and children. How's that for sexism and misogyny? And as to their sexual preferences, who cares? Only you, Democrats, care. The fact is, the administration of Biden and Harris, which crashed and burned through the night last night in a spectacular worthy of Elon Musk, it is over for them, as it is over for such people all over the Western world. Mark my words, only one in three British voters voted for Keir Starmer. Only one in five of all British voters voted for Keir Starmer. He'll have to sack Didi Amin Lamy, Big Dada. You'll have to dismiss him now because Britain's foreign secretary called the new president of the United States a supporter of the Ku Klux Klan and a Nazi. Clearly, the special relationship cannot survive it. The Rachel Maddows, the Mehdi Hassans, the liberals in the networks and in the leader columns of the fancy newspapers don't know what's hit them. And that is the problem. Their bubble, you see, is entirely sufficient for them. They feed off each other. They talk to each other. They reinforce each other's personal prejudices. They kept telling you that Kamala was the candidate for women, but most women voted Trump. And overwhelmingly so in the case of white women. They kept telling you that women in America cared more about abortion than they did about the price of milk and eggs and housing and gasoline. They really believed that. But women in America need eggs and milk more often than they need an abortion. This rabid preoccupation with liberal nostrums, with a dogma more dogmatic than any of the Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church. The dogma of liberalism is what has done them. They don't understand that the vast majority of people out there in America, in Europe, all over the Western world, the vast majority of people don't give a toss about all that. They're interested in their lives. It's the economy, stupid. It's the culture, stupid. It's the sense of being secure and part of your own country and not despised and reviled by the people who rule you. Kamala Harris, like Hillary Clinton before her, showed it all over again and again and again. Latterly, by not showing up to her scheduled speech at Brown University, or Howard University, rather, in the United States, where thousands of her supporters were waiting for her. She took to her bed like Hillary Clinton did before her. Not a good look, that, for those telling us we need a woman president. It would be marvelous to have a woman president, but not a woman president who's an idiot. That would actually set women back. That's what most women calculate. They said that Trump was a KKK member. They said that Trump was a Nazi. They said that Trump was Hitler, but his share of the vote amongst black people, amongst Latinos, amongst Asians, amongst other ethnicities has vaulted forward in the case of Latinos almost to parity. When Latinos used to vote 80 to 90% for the Democratic Party. And they thought that they could murder thousands of people, tens, scores of thousands of people in Lebanon and in Gaza, and still expect young people, much motivated by the justice of the Palestinian cause, still enthusiastically to vote for them. They thought they could get Iraqi Americans to vote for a party whose leading proponent in the last few days of the campaign was the daughter of Dick Cheney, who murdered a million Iraqis in 2003 and beyond. The insanity of this political class. Rory Stewart, I know, who even remembers the guy? But you'll find his books in the bookshops. You'll find him on the screen. You'll find him paid thousands of pounds as a pundit, though he's a blithering idiot as a pundit. Everything he predicts turns out to be wrong. And the war criminal, Alistair Campbell, what a gruesome twosome. They were on the television all through the night predicting wrongly, state after state after state, because these people are not journalists, they are not broadcasters, they are political activists who confuse what it is they want with what is actually going to happen, what is happening on the ground. This was, above all, a revolt of the American working class. One of the great gains of this campaign is the abandonment of this ludicrous term, middle class, to describe blue-collar union labor in the United States of America. Suddenly everyone is talking about the working class in America. It is the working class in America, of all colors, that has been penurized, has been anathematized, slandered and smeared as ignorant, as illiterate, as lacking in the social graces, as garbage, as deplorables. It's the working class what done it for Donald Trump, and he better not disappoint them. If Donald Trump picks the monsters from the swamp like he did last time and puts them in charge of vital areas of America's national life, his administration will fail. If he genuinely puts America first, he will succeed. He will make America great again. I say this with all love to the American people. Stay home and fix house. Get your soldiers out of Syria. Get your soldiers out of Iraq. Get your materiel, men, money, and diplomatic support out of Ukraine. Get out from under the mass murderer, Benjamin Netanyahu. Go home, America. I say it with love. Go home, America. Yankee, go home and fix your own country. Fix your roads. Fix your bridges. Fix your railways. Fix your housing stock. Fix the living standards of your own people. Fix the racial and other divides amongst your countrymen and women. Heal yourselves, physician, before seeking to heal the rest of us. We love you, but we don't need you. We don't want to be you. We won't agree to be ruled by you. And that's in your interest to heed this call. Heaven knows, God blessed America. Heaven knows from sea to shining sea, you have been blessed with everything that nature can bestow. Use it. Use it for good, for the good of your own people, first and foremost. Put America first, Mr. Trump. Keep the neocon, realcon, retread, recycled, George Bush, warmongering, genocide-loving, Elliot Abrams, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, to the garbage can with them. Give RFK Jr. the power to tackle Big Pharma. Give Tulsi Gabbard the power to pursue at least a remotely ethical foreign policy. Clean house, clean the Augean stable of all these criminals that hunted you. This is the greatest comeback since the rumble in the jungle, since Muhammad Ali shuffled and flattened the big, ugly bear, George Foreman, though Kamala Harris will never make a living selling barbecue sets after this. Matter of fact, she can go back to finally working in McDonald's, where she never worked all along. She can go back to being an Indian. She can drop her kaleidoscope of accents. A Southern belle here, down with the kids in the ghetto there. She can stop pretending all the...
Well, I'm going to flip over the tape here. This is George Galloway. Last night from London, he was on a rant on his mother of all talk shows, Moat. And I think he had... one thing wrong. Trying to fit the tape in the slot here. That I think Kamala Harris did get 53% of the women's vote, but it was down from what Biden and Hillary Clinton had gotten, 54-57%, something like that, if I remember some place I saw. But anyway, let's continue on with. So he's a left-winger, long-time activist in England. So Keir Starmer, of course, is one who was recently elected prime minister on the for the Labour Party.
Campaign. This comeback of yours, Donald Trump, gives you an enormous mandate. And you can't run again. You don't need to do anything to please these special interests, these lobbyists that will now be swarming around you as earlier they were swarming to destroy you. President Trump, you have 4 years to make America genuinely shining city on a hill. You'll be greatly helped by the mass exodus of all of those that promised they were leaving the country. Bono was going to leave life. He's going to drive a car off a cliff. Hundreds are gathering at cliff tops all over the country waiting for him to show up and keep his promise. Tom Hanks is going to take a one-way ticket to Canada. Me and Gayatri are on our way to America in January. Maybe we'll live there for a little while. Make America the freest country in the world. Heaven knows that actually won't be that difficult. It might be easier for me to live in America and work in America. Imagine that. Starmer, Macron, Schultz, Baerbock. You're not the leaders of the free world. You're the leaders of the imprisoned world. The imprisoned people. of Western European countries are going to rise up like the American working class has just risen up. You are going to be swept away. And while we wait for that, thanks to Trump and Carlson and Musk and those who at least recognize the meaning of the First Amendment and why it is the First Amendment, because all other freedoms depend upon the First Amendment, freedom of speech. Take a bow, Elon Musk. This would not have happened if you had not liberated Twitter from the CIA, FBI, DOJ, White House nexus, which controlled it with a fist around its neck. It is true that Tucker Carlson, Elon Musk, ex Max Blumenthal, Gerald Calente, me, the mother of all talk shows, we are the media now. All these discredited, weeping husks that you see literally wearing black in mourning today on the American television show The View, some of them literally weeping on camera. They didn't get their way. They're not used to that. They're used to being able to terrorize the rest of us into silence and compliance. They are used to being able to insist. Well, in the early hours of this morning, they got their comeuppance. I was up for Pennsylvania. Were you? As a matter of fact, I haven't yet been to bed. So if I seem unduly lighthearted, unduly light-minded even, it's because I have just watched the worst people on the earth, the worst people on the earth, having to eat their bitter but just desserts. It is the mother of all talk shows. You want to stay tuned. I'll be right back.
Well, that was George Galloway, and he was very his rant about the election, and I'm going to, I don't have much time left, but I'm going to give another announcement about that community teach-in a week from tonight. You may want to get together with people, talk about things, but they're going to be talking about things to do in the future. It's a no weapons, no war. Learn and share knowledge about weapons manufacturers operating in Minnesota. They reach deep into metro areas, the history of resistance against them, and what we can do now. So a week from tonight, Thursday, November 14th, at 6:30 p.m., it's going to be at the New City Center, 31st and 16th Avenue. Used to be Walker Church, but they have things have changed there. And so I want to say that this is the been the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson.
Welcome to MN90. Minnesota history in 90 seconds.
She was Amy Elizabeth Thorpe once upon a time. Born in Minneapolis in 1910 to a Marine Corps officer and the daughter of a state senator, Betty learned early on how to mix with the powerful. In 1936, she married Arthur Pack and became Betty Pack. But a 2016 biography by Howard Bloom, The Last Good Night, a World War II story of espionage, adventure, and betrayal, details how Betty Pak became an undercover agent for the British and Americans. Pak was suited to her new profession. She was an adventurer, driven to take risks, and had an ability to tell a lie with utter sincerity and to seduce men. Above all, she was a patriot. Her exploits, including the theft of ciphers and information on the Enigma machine, did their part to win World War II for the Allies. After the war, Pak married a second time to one of her informants and died in France in 1963.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.